Today's Taisho will be on case 68 in the Iron Flute. Yunmen's 3 days. Yunmen said to his monks one day, "There is a saying, 3 days can make a different person. What about you?" Before anyone could answer, he said quietly, 1,000. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice this beautiful path of Zen. Everybody was sitting very deeply. It was really wonderful this morning. And I want to thank all of you who have come just to hear the talk. If this is your first time at a Zen talk, the subjects for these Taisho, these talks, or Dharma talks, generally speaking, the subject will be taken from a collection of koans. And koans are unique to the Zen school of Buddhism. Originally in Buddhism, people practiced vipassana, shamatha and vipassana, calming the mind and being aware of the moment. And this was the standard practice in Buddhism for probably about 1,000 years. Around, say, the 5th century, a group of people, meditators, very deep explorers of the human mind, realized that there was another level to the mind which earlier Buddhists hadn't been aware of. And this is what we in the West call the unconscious mind. Unconscious mind, and what Buddhist traditions calls the alaya vijnana, the storehouse mind. So this discovery of another layer to the mind led to a kind of revolution in Buddhist meditation practice. Before, people seeking enlightenment learned how to calm their minds and learned how to be mindful of the moment. But now they could also use the power of the unconscious mind to push themselves towards awakening more powerfully and more quickly. And this was really the beginning of what is known as the Mahayana. The earlier school of Buddhism is now thought of as the Theravada, the way of the elders, the way of the ancestors. And this new school is called the Mahayana, the Great Way. Now, in India, as a matter of fact, Mahayana and Theravada monks and nuns all practiced together in the same temples. There was no tension or competition. These were different approaches to meditation practice. But there's a great deal of evidence now that and they got along very well, and they practiced together in the same locations. Different people have different psychologies and require different strategies for waking up. And this is well known in Buddhism. The Buddha himself taught differently to different people. So sometimes the Buddha was addressing people who were quite distracted and quite unable to free themselves from violent or destructive habits. So when he spoke to those people, he didn't emphasize advanced meditation practice. He put great stress on leading an ethical life and on the law of cause and effect. So when the Buddha talked to people who had problems just being decent human beings and who had done sometimes really bad things, he put an emphasis on ethical conduct, being being an ethical person. When he was dealing with people who were quite ethical, who conducted themselves well and who were practicing meditation, but hadn't been able to break through to awakening, he taught rather different, rather differently. So in Buddhism, there's this tradition of what are called skillful means, that the Buddha used means to help people wake up that were appropriate to their condition, initial condition. So this is called upaya, skillful means. So all the different kinds of meditation traditions could be thought of as upaya. So in China and Japan, there is a tradition of what's called Pure Land Buddhism, where people recite verses from key sutras, often from the Lotus Sutra. And in Chinese, this is known as Nyenfo practice. And in Japan, also, this is quite widespread. People start initially by just reciting these lines from the sutras as a kind of a devotional activity. And eventually, they fall into deep samadhi. And eventually they can achieve actually advanced states of meditative awareness, including awakening. So other people, like in the Tibetan school, use, say, visualization techniques, where Tibetan Buddhism is often trying to help people who have my theory is that Tibetan Buddhism is really very good for people who have low self-esteem or who have a sense of powerlessness. And Tibetan Buddhism has a kind of meditation strategy among hundreds of meditation strategies in which people learn to visualize themselves as a deity. And you gradually identify more and more with a kind of a deva figure, Buddhist deva figure. And this is an initial or intermediate stage of meditation practice in Tibetan Buddhism. And many people are deeply transformed by this and eventually go on to have a deep awakening experience. In Zen or Chan or Jhana, practice primarily in two different ways. Sometimes people do what is known as shikantaza, or simply vipassana meditation, awareness of the moment. But at other times people practice what is known as koan zen. And koans are subjects for meditation that you internalize while you're meditating. So you have to be able to enter samadhi, a one-pointed mind, and you have to be able to achieve shamatha, calm mind, calm and focused mind. And when you are in samadhi and you have achieved shamatha, you begin to work with the koan. And the koan can be the mu koan, or a number of other koans, and there's literally hundreds of them, as a matter of fact. And today, this koan is from a collection called the Iron Flute, and it involves a great Zen master from the Tang Dynasty named Cloud Gate Yunmen, and it's a little dialogue or a little moment in his Taisho. Yunmen said to his monks one day, "There is a saying, 3 days can make a different person. What about you?" Before anyone could answer, he said quietly, 1,000. So this is actually a little story, but it doesn't make any sense if you try to figure it out. You could try to think about what it might mean symbolically, or you could try to think about what it might mean in terms of Buddhist values. But that really wouldn't get you very far. This koan is not intended to be a parable or a fable. It's not intended to make an ethical point in a direct way. It's a subject for meditation, and you have to internalize it. You have to take it deep into your mind, and it begins to draw on the power of the unconscious, this tremendous power in the human mind to liberate us from illusion. So it's like throwing a stone into a well. The stone goes down, down, down into the well, and when you look into the well, nothing seems to be happening, but gradually the well, the mind, is transformed. And so a person who was able to enter deep samadhi might be given this koan by the teacher, and then the person will work with the koan, sometimes for many months, and gradually there's a process of transformation that goes on. And little by little, you're working through some kind of an inner obstacle. So very often we have fears and attachments that prevent us from being fully in the moment, prevent us from being fully awake. And we are generally not even aware of those fears and attachments. There are some fears and attachments we know about, you know. But many of our fears and attachments, many of our inner obstacles, are invisible even to us. And you see this all the time. You know, you might know somebody who has a kind of a fiery temper. And sometimes people like that don't even know. You know, they'll get angry, and you can say, "Oh, you're angry," and they'll go, "I'm not angry," you know, when they're furious. And you might know people who are very vacillating and timid. And they might, in their minds, they might see themselves as very courageous and very, you know, very resolute and determined, you know. That's quite often the case, that people have very false images of themselves and really can't see their own blindnesses and obstacles. So the function of the koan is to help us encounter these hidden barriers in ourselves. So hopefully, if we all have the chance to practice together for a long time, we might work together on Yunmen's 3 days. So very little that I'm going to say today about the koan is going to be very helpful when that moment comes and you have to work on it deep within your samadhi. But for now, it's a way of talking about Zen practice in general. So when you do the koan, by the way, what you want to do is internalize the what are called the turning words. The key words in this little story are 3 days. So you just sit on the cushion and enter deep samadhi and enter mushin and then just say 3 days, 3 days, 3 days, 3 days. And you might think that nothing will happen. You might think, well, what's going to happen if I do that? But believe me, something quite dramatic will indeed happen as you internalize this koan. But today I wanted to use the koan as a way of talking about something that's not always discussed in the context of Zen practice. And that is our relationships to one another in a sangha. You know. In Buddhist tradition, there are said to be three jewels, or a triple jewel, sometimes tri-ratna. And the three jewels are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And basically the idea is that people who are on this path, you don't have to be a Buddhist, but you don't have to call yourself a Buddhist, but you must see something valuable in the teachings of the Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And so even if you're not a Buddhist, you don't have to be, you're following this path because you see something valuable in these teachings. So that's Buddha. The second one is a dharm. Now, the dharm refers to teachings, the Buddha's teachings. So if you're a student of Zen, you follow Buddha, dharm, and that would be basically the sutras and also the koans, right? And then finally, there's this idea of sangha, which is a community of practice. Now, you know, in the modern world, people are very individualistic. And we understand, we might understand Buddha. We might understand Buddha, you know. I mean, maybe you read a book on Buddhism or Zen and you think, I'd like to give this a try. That's how it was for me. I read a book on Buddhism and thought, wow, this is so cool, you know. These people having these enlightenment experiences, I'd like to have that, you know. So you might get interested in Buddhism, you know. You might start reading some of the actual teachings of the Buddha or more books on Buddhism. When it comes to practicing, it's a little different because you can probably teach yourself to do zazen on your own, but actually it's very rare to meet such people. You know, I occasionally get calls from people asking about meditation practice. And I typically will say, you know, have you ever done meditation? And they're very hesitant. They'll say, well, I've done a little bit on my own. And then I'll say, well, what kind of meditation? And they're very vague. It's because it's very difficult to do this without the appropriate instruction and the appropriate setting. You know, we modern people are so individualistic, you know, we make all of our decisions based upon personal preferences. And we like to see ourselves as rugged individuals, right? This is like an American ideal, to be an individual, you know, stand on your own two feet, and so on. And we make a lot of decisions this way. You know, you might become a Democrat or a Republican based upon something you read in a magazine. And it's easy to do, right? But practicing Zen's a little different because actually it's almost indispensable to have sangha, have a community. And some of you may be aware of this, you know. Every once in a while, somebody will come up to me and tell me, you know, I don't know why, but when I sit here with other people, I have a better sit. In Zen, we call meditation a sit. Zazen, Dzogchen, means seated meditation. So for short, we just say a sit. How was your sit? Okay. So, people often come up to me and will say, I don't know why, but when I do this at home, I have a better sit. Yeah? And it's true, probably, for a long time. You know, when you sit at home, you should definitely practice at home. I hope you are. You know, it's good if you have a place in your house that you keep separate for your mat and your cushion, and maybe you have a little altar with a candle and some incense or something. It's a good idea to actually do that. And so there's a place in your house where you have like a little meditation center of your own. And this is a good incentive to practice because, you know, if you're running around the house and you haven't done your meditation for the day and you see your cushion on the ground, you might think, uh-oh, you know, I haven't done my meditation, I better do it, you know. It's like a reminder. And if you skip a day or you skip a little while and you look and you see that cushion, it's like you begin to feel maybe guilty, which is good, you know. Then you think, I better get on that cushion, you know. I should always treat it with respect, you know, keep it clean. Don't throw your dirty laundry over there. You can throw it on the other side of the room, you know. So having your own practice space is very important. And sitting on a regular basis is absolutely crucial. So, you know, maybe you get up 4 or 5 times a week and you sit on, you do meditation on your own. When you sit on the cushion, it might be early morning, you might be tired. So, you know, nobody's around, so you yawn, right? And maybe you have to sniffle, so you sniffle, and maybe your head itches, and after 15 minutes you scratch your head. For various reasons, unless you're very, very disciplined, it's not easy to practice on your own. You know, when you come in here, you have to try to sit properly. You have to sit without moving for half an hour. And, you know, if you want to scratch your head, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to yawn loudly. You're not supposed to sniffle at all. You know, I'll yell at you if you sniffle. You know? So you have to sit very quietly, and you have to, there's like an incentive to try harder. You know, it's an incentive to try harder. If you are a jogger, I've been a jogger even longer than I've been practicing Zen. Since I was about 15, so almost 40 years I've been a jogger. And, you know, I can tell you, some days I just get up, and if I go for a run, some days I'm just not into it. You know, I'm running, but as we say in English, my ass is dragging, you know. And I'm just plodding along. And I'll be running down the street and somebody will see me. And people have actually said, hey, pick up the pace, you know, because I'm just so slow, right? It's like a turtle going down the road, you know. So I've actually had people go, hey, pick up the pace, you know. And I'll pick it up for a little while until I'm past them and then I can slow down. But if you jog with other people, you have to pick up the pace. It's like self-respect, you know. So if you're jogging with other people, you want to keep up. You don't want to be the, you know, left behind person. So basically it helps to practice with other people. And of course, if you've come to Sesshin, our wonderful meditation retreats, our Chan Chi retreats, you know that there's this powerful collective energy that comes from doing this together. And it's extraordinary, really. Even on a Thursday evening or a Monday or Friday evening sit, when people get together and do this together, there's a kind of extraordinary collective energy mutually supporting one another on our path to awakening. And, you know, if there's somebody in the room who sits really well, you know, people notice that. You know, people will notice, you know, that person didn't take any breaks. My teacher Genki Roshi, my first teacher Genki Roshi, could sit forever. I would just look at him and he'd be sitting there, and you know, there was no sweat on his brow or anything, just be beautifully calm. You know, he could sit for like, I don't know, 7 hours or things like, it was amazing, you know. And I would look at him and just think, I could never do that, you know, but I would still try. And I remember the day came once when the bell rang at the end of a sit, and instead of moving, I thought, well, why don't I go for it? You know, why don't I try to sit through this and see what happens? The worst thing that will happen is I'll be in pain and I'll have to move and I'll be a little embarrassed. But, you know, I made it all the way through, and it was like, wow! And my concentration was so deep, you know. My concentration was so deep. So there's something very, very special about Sangha, about a community of practice. You know, it's virtually impossible to do this on your own. You know, we Americans like to believe that we're individuals. You know, we can do whatever we want, et cetera, et cetera. But really, you couldn't really be a great scientist on your own. You know, if you read a bunch of scientist books and you sent away for some Erlenmeyer flasks and some test tubes and so on, you know, there's no way you're going to put together all the advances that have been made in modern chemistry on your own, right? It's just not going to happen. And, you know, if you want to be a great writer and you want to read a lot of books, it's actually much easier if you take some English courses, right? Because, you know, you could buy 12 books and say, I'm going to read them. But, you know, they're going to sit on the shelf for a long time, probably, right? If you have a class and the teacher says, in this class, we're going to read 12 books this semester. You know, you can fake it, right? You don't have to read all 12, you know. But you have to read more of them to get through, the tests or the quizzes. And you have to read maybe at least a couple of them very carefully to write your papers. So there's a kind of incentive that comes from working collectively, yes? And there's a kind of collective energy. If you see people sitting deeply and enthusiastically, it carries over. And in this way, people in all areas of human life make extraordinary achievements, you know. It's true for the arts, you know. I have a lot of friends through my wife's family who are artists, and it's very hard to be an isolated artist. You know, it's very hard to be working and living by yourself. And most people who try to be creative on their own aren't successful in being creative on their own. You need the company of others. It's one of the reasons artists often get together and try to live in the same town. You know, you have these art communities, and you think, what's that all about? You know, but if you look at people like Gauguin, in the beautiful French Impressionists, you know, Gauguin, Van Gogh, Degas. All of these people knew each other, and they knew each other long before Pizarro, long before they were famous. They all knew each other because they were interested in the arts, they loved the arts, they were doing exciting things, and they wanted to share and get inspiration from others, you know? And they were doing such things that were so original, they wondered if they were crazy or not, you know? So they met other people who were doing interesting things and showed their art to their friends, and their friends said, oh, that's not crazy, that's beautiful, you know, so they help. So the point is that human beings really are social beings, you know. It helps enormously to have sangha. And even though we often think of people meditating in solitude, you know, we think of the Buddha meditating in solitude, you know, just before his great awakening. It's important to understand that even the Buddha had teachers. You know, even the Buddha had fellow meditators. You know, the Buddha studied with the foremost meditation teachers of his time. And he went through all the teachings they could offer him, and then went further. And when he was trying to have his great awakening, he got together with a bunch of people who were also trying to wake up. And they all sat together day after day after day. And only just before his great awakening did the Buddha go off by himself and wake up. So I think we have in the modern world cultural prejudice in favor of individualism. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's very important to be an individual. But it's very important also to see just how precious, how really, if you love Zen, you I hope you appreciate the importance of Sangha, of community. It's just terribly, terribly important. Enlightenment is really not possible without it. So that's a very important element. And now, one of the interesting things about a community, though, is there's the ideal and there's the reality, you know. And the reality is usually more complicated than the ideal. So years ago, I've talked about this before, but years ago I went to visit a temple that was under the direction of the person who was a close friend of my first teacher, Genki Roshi. This teacher's name is Edo Shimano Roshi, and he has a beautiful temple in the middle of New York. It's a beautiful Japanese-style building on a lake. If you were to dream up the perfect location, the perfect place, this would be it. One of his students was the wife, one of Edo Roshi's students was the wife of the president of the 3M company, the people who make Scotch tape, you know. And all that Scotch tape really adds up, you know. So they were wildly wealthy, and they donated, like, I don't know, 500 acres or something. Really, it's like a huge amount of land. Maybe it's more than that. It might be 1,000. It takes forever just to get to the temple. When you get off the road, you drive for 15 or 20 minutes just to get to the temple. So it's very remote, beautiful forest. When you drive in, you see a beautiful lake, and you drive over a little waterfall, you know, a bridge above a waterfall. Then you drive through these trees, and you come up to the temple, and you could think you're in Japan. It's so beautiful, you know. And anybody coming there would think this is the ideal, right? This is a beautiful community. So one day I got there a little early, and I was going for a walk around the lake, and I ran into this person who was sitting on the edge of the water, looking very sad. And he was throwing rocks into the water, and I said, you know, hi, how's it going, you know? And he said, oh, I'm a student here. I came from Belgium. And I said, well, how do you like it? And he said, I hate it. And I said, well, what's wrong? And he said, oh, it's such an unhappy place. Everybody argues all the time. See, everybody argues all the time. And I said to him, look, you know, temples are not filled with enlightened people. They're filled with people who want to wake up. See, they're filled with people who want to wake up. But they're not awake, you know. Hopefully there's one or two awakened people there, or it's just a madhouse, right? But generally speaking, most people have not had a great awakening experience or cleared away all their many of their karmic obstacles. So the thing is, this is not necessarily, you know, this is not necessarily how we like to think about a community, and it's not I would say that community wasn't functioning properly. You know, it was like a dysfunctional family. The people were arguing all the time, and that's not, I think, a healthy relationship. You know, I think in our own community, you know, we all started practicing with Genki Roshi when he arrived from Japan. And we had high ideals. You know, when Genki Roshi came, he was like the total Zen master. I mean, he was such a kind. It was like having the Dalai Lama, your own Dalai Lama. You know, he was such a kind person. He was so generous. He was very humble. He worked very hard. He sat like a mountain when he would sit down. It was extraordinary. And basically, we were all American kids, you know? We were all a bunch of American kids. And, you know, it was interesting what happened in our group. And I haven't seen it here, but I wanted to talk about it. It's something that has come up in another context, and I thought it was important to talk about it, you know? People sort of fell in love with Genki Roshi. It's like falling in love. When you find a teacher you really like, it could be like love, right? Like falling in love. And when you fall in love, you know, deeply, you want to be in the presence of your beloved a lot, like all the time even, you know? And you want to be liked by the person you love. You want to be loved by the person you love. Right? This is like a relationship. And I can tell you that when I met my wife, I fell in love with my wife, and I wanted her to see me in the best possible light. You know, I wanted for a long time. I really wanted her to just see the best part of me. You know, and when I started studying with Genki Roshi, I had that same attitude. You know, I wanted Genki Roshi just to see the best part of me. In fact, I was afraid of being around him too much because I thought he'd see that I wasn't such a great person after all, you know. So I was actually a little ashamed sometimes around him. I'd try to be on my best behavior. But the point is, you know, if you have 30 people all relating to the teacher in this way, it can create a strange atmosphere in the community. Because it's a little bit like what's called a sibling rivalry. Do you know that phrase, sibling rivalry? It's like brothers and sisters all want to be loved by mom and dad. And even though you might not think so, they become competitors for mom and dad's love. This is part of a family dynamic. It's inescapable. My brother and I were competitors for my parents' love. There's no question about it. You know, my brother was a real athlete. He was a track type star. You know, he was really, and I did go out for track, but I was like a loser. I could never do anything. And my brother loved to, when he was even a little kid, he loved to, you know, call my parents out and go, look at, and he'd run, you know, he'd show my parents how fast he could run. And actually, I was actually like a very chubby little kid. And I couldn't run fast at all, and I'd get really tired. And so my brother really went into athletics because he could be better, I think, than I was at it, you know. And my parents loved to go to his meets and see him win. And I think I got good in school because I couldn't figure out how to be good in anything else. And I wanted my parents to see me as a lovable child. You know, I wanted my parents to love me, and I was trying to earn their love by being a good student. And so my brother and I had a lot of rivalry. And when my brother had his own kids, he really tried not to encourage that kind of rivalry. We were both aware of it, and we were embarrassed by it when we became adults. But my brother said it was so hard to keep it from happening. One time he said his daughter and his son would argue all the time, you know, trying to get be noticed, you know, and they'd fight and fight and fight and fight. And he said in his car he has a divider. It's a kind of armrest that you could pull down from the seat. So he put one child in the back seat on the right and one child in the back seat on the left. And he said, both of you stay there. And he brought the divider down, right? And he said after he was driving for about 20 minutes, he looked in the back and both of them had their arms on the divider, both kids, and they were trying to squeeze each other off the divider, and they had their other arm on the side of the car, right? You know? So they're fighting for territory, right? So even though we think we're rational beings and adults, you know, these dynamics are present in all human beings. We all feel deeply unlovable. And we all feel that we need to do something to make ourselves lovable. And we are always in relationships with people we admire that have a kind of that involve a kind of hunger for approval. And also, when we are in a complex social setting, we can find ourselves feeling emotions that are connected to, like, sibling rivalry. Hope I'm not sounding too abstract. And I'm not trying to... I think this is true. I think that basically, in our group, we had a lot of sibling rivalry in Seattle, and we didn't know how to deal with it, you know? And I think, generally speaking, modern people don't know how to deal with these emotions a lot of the time. Americans are raised to be very individualistic. I was reading this book. It was quite an interesting book. It was on preschool in three countries. It was a Japanese preschool, a Taiwanese preschool, and an American preschool. And they were looking at the way little children interacted with other children. see. And the interesting thing was that the Japanese children had the highest level of awareness of the other children. In other words, this was not genetic. Their culture emphasized paying attention to the needs of others and interrelating with others. Very high emphasis on, and maybe too much in Japanese culture on this. The Taiwanese kids were a lot like the Japanese kids, but not to the same degree. They were a little less aware of other kids. And the American kids were totally unaware of the other kids. You know, they're all sort of doing their thing. Now, you know, that has its pluses. All of these have their pluses and their minuses. But I think modern American people are not always able to deal with like group dynamics because there are these elements of tension or rivalry. And in our case, it eventually led to like a lot of explosive emotions, believe it or not. This hasn't happened in our group. But if you look at the history of Zen in America, all over the country, after about 15 years of Zen centers operating, you begin to have like these explosive tensions. And you see this in many social settings. You see this in churches, synagogues, you see this in English departments, strangely enough, you know, where the desire for recognition turns people into competitors, right? And I hope I'm making sense, you know. But people in their insecurities can be suddenly very bothered by other things, you know. So, for example, at the last session, there was a person who came in to see me. In fact, this happens at every session. It happens at every session. Somebody will come in to see me and say, "He's driving me crazy." And I'll say, "Who? What?" You know. And he'll say, "Can't you hear it?" "Hear what?" "The breathing." You know. "The breathing." I said, "No, I can hardly hear anything. You know, my hearing's not that good." You know. So, but he'll say, "Oh my God." Or, you know, somebody will come in and say, "He's moving all the time. It's driving me out of my mind, you know." Really, I mean, it's happening. And it's like, who? Who's moving? Oh, who cares, you know. I mean, and, you know, my feeling is, look, if you're in deep samadhi, you shouldn't even notice. It just shouldn't matter, you know. But people, this is very complicated, really, right? I mean, in our group, we had all these tensions. You know, people would. There was a guy who became the first monk in our group. And in Genki Roshi, when Genki Roshi started our Zen group, he didn't ask anybody to take vows or make any kind of commitments. We were just practicing together. But there was one person who was very, he seemed very full of himself. You know, he was always calling attention to himself. You know, he seemed like one of these people who said, you know, "Enough about me, what do you think of me?" You know, he was that kind of a person. So, you know, whenever he did a good deed, he made sure everybody knew, you know. It was like, and this was brought to you by me, you know. And he was very—he was just kind of a—you know—he was—I don't know how to put it—you know—kind of a nudge, you know, or something. So anyway, he went to Genki Roshi after training for about a year, and he said, "I want to become a monk. I want to become a priest." And Genki Roshi didn't say, "Oh, you're too much of a nudge, you know. No way, you know." He said, "Sure. Wait a year, and I'll ordain you." So anyway, Genki Roshi was like this, like the Dalai Lama. It was like having your personal Dalai Lama, you know. But this guy, he wore, you know, he shaved his head, he had robes, but he wasn't like the Dalai Lama, you know. He was very full of himself. He was so he seemed so egotistical, you know. And it created a lot of bad feelings in the community. You know, because we all thought, you know, if you're a monk, you need to be like Genki Roshi. And this guy was just a kind of a jerk, really, you know? And people were, you know, he'd say or do things, and after we sat, we sometimes would go get coffee, you know? And people would say, "Did you hear what he said today? Oh, my God. Oh. You know, he's a monk, you know?" People were so, I have to say that eventually, our group was torn apart by these kinds of emotions. You know, because, I mean, who cares whether he's a real monk or not, right? I mean, as we say in English, it's no skin off your ass, you know? Are you pursuing awakening or not, see? But it bugged a lot of people in our group that Joe had become the monk, you know? And he really was, you know, he was quite immature. He was just a very, very immature person. So anyway, we had a lot of these tensions that built up over time. Some of them involved Joe, and some of them involved many other things. But eventually we bought a beautiful site for our temple up in the mountains, and we all worked together, and we built the zendo and the kitchen. And everything was going so beautifully. But unfortunately, we began to have serious financial difficulties because we were financially overextended. People who had committed to supporting the community began to leave. They moved to other places, and they weren't contributing to paying the land off, you know. So anyway, Genjo decided, Joe Genjo was his name, this monk, he decided that the solution to this problem was to, even though we were deeply in debt, to buy a place in the city also, right? And it's like spending money to make money. So he did find a house, and it was a beautiful house. And he thought, if we have a house in Seattle that's very visible and it's in a good location, we'll attract more members. And even my wife was willing to move in there, which is a miracle. You know. Many of you have never met my wife. In fact, almost nobody has. She's not really into Zen, you know, but she actually agreed to move in. It was like, huh, you know. But at the last minute, a lot of people in the group said, "Wait a minute, this is crazy, right? We're already in debt, and we're going to go even deeper in debt?" So it created like civil, you know, it had a split over a very important issue. And it created like a civil war. And it eventually blew our group to pieces. It really, literally, it caused like a civil war. And there were all these bitter letters in the newsletter, bitter, angry letters, and it was really tragic, you know? And eventually the group just fell apart. This happens all over the United States. And I think it has to do with not knowing how to be together as a group, you know? Zen practice is, in some ways, very individualistic, right? Nobody can wake up for you. Right? Nobody can wake up for you. When you're on the cushion and you're in pain and you're struggling, that's like you're all alone, right? You're really alone with your pain, with your difficulty, trying to focus on mu. And when you have your wonderful sit, that's also something, you know, you can only have by yourself. And when you have daikensho, it's something, you know, there's no such thing as like a collective daikensho. In some religious traditions, there's like an idea of like a collective ecstasy. But not in Buddhism. I think Buddhism's very truthful about this, you know. People have to wake up one person at a time. But on the other hand, you know, it's also the case that when you wake up, what you discover is that you're not one person. There's no such thing as individual, even though the path to enlightenment is an individual path, you know. If you don't sit, nothing's going to happen. His sitting isn't going to help you, right? If you don't sit this week and you come to sit next week, and somebody's been sitting, you know, I love prayer wheels, right? Prayer wheels, you know, there's prayers in there, and they turn and they turn. In fact, they hook them up to water, right? So the prayer wheels turn, and you know what prayer wheels are full of? They're full of prayers. And so nobody has to sit there and say those prayers. The wheels are turning. And the idea is it just goes up. You know, the prayers go up. You don't even need a person. You know, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It really doesn't work, as a matter of fact. It's a mistaken idea, right? Only prayers that matter are the ones that somebody says, right? Putting prayers in a drum and turning it with water, it's not working, right? So it's the same thing with sitting, you know. If somebody in the room has been sitting a lot, it doesn't cross over. The energy doesn't cross over necessarily to you, you know. You have to do it yourself. But on the other hand, there's no such thing as individual enlightenment. When you wake up, you realize that everybody is part of one life. So it's absolutely crucial to understand that your practice is not just your practice. It's everybody else's practice too. When we come together like this and we sit together, if there is somebody in the room who's sitting well, it is contagious. It can't give you the energy. But you look over and you say, by gosh, you know, Yin is really sitting well today. I'm going to try a little harder. See, we're all on the road to awakening, and we all actually all need each other, and we're all one life. So it's very, very important, you know, to be aware that there are these tensions in a social setting like this. There can be a kind of competitiveness, right? If this is not a problem for you, wonderful. But there can be a kind of competitiveness, and I've seen it in many Zen communities. And if you feel a little competitiveness, don't feel ashamed. It's a human emotion, right? We all want to be the best at what we do, right? And I used to sit a full lotus just because I wanted to be a good sitter. I wanted to be the best sitter, right? But that's not the best person I can be, right? You know, at some point I'm not practicing for myself anymore. I'm not practicing for myself anymore. I realize that this is I'm practicing with others, for others too, right? It's like, you know, I love this phrase. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Stephen Batchelor. It's called Alone with Others. See, Alone with Others. In Zen, we're alone with others. You know, we are alone on the cushion, but in another sense, you know, we're all here together, and it's a wonderful thing. It's infinitely precious. And so, you know, there's a dimension of practice which is takes place on the cushion. Dimension of practice that takes place on the cushion. And there's a dimension of practice that takes place when you get off the cushion and you interact with your Dharma brothers and sisters. And and remember, you know, we're all modern people. And we're not trained to be necessarily very alert to the needs of and concerns of our fellow human being. It's not part of our socialization as Americans. It's just not. We're trained to be competitors, as a matter of fact. The whole culture trains us to be competitive. So you shouldn't be ashamed of your competitive emotions. It's your culture talking. But, you know, if somebody has a good sit, and you didn't, you know, the proper feeling in your heart is to say, I'm so happy for you, and to really mean it. And if somebody answers a koan and you didn't answer a koan, the proper feeling you should have is, I love you. I'm so happy for your success today. You know? This is the proper spirit. And it's not something that comes automatically. See, it's not something that comes automatically to people. It's something we have to work on. We have to this is practice off the cushion. Very, very important. Okay, this is taking a long time. I'll wrap it up. But I just have one lovely story that I want to read you. This is a famous Zen story about a... Well, hang on. Here it is. Okay. When Bankei, this is a great Japanese master, Bankei. When Bankei held his sesshin, pupils came from many parts of Japan to attend. During one of these gatherings, a pupil was caught stealing. The matter was reported to Bankei. This is in the middle of the sesshin. Somebody stole something. The matter was reported to Bankei with the request that the culprit be expelled. Bankei ignored the case. Later, the pupil was caught doing it again. And again, Bankei disregarded the matter. This angered the other pupils, who drew up a petition asking for the dismissal of the thief, stating that otherwise they would leave together. When Bankei read the petition, he called everybody together and he said, "You are wise brothers. You know what is right and what is not right. You may go somewhere else if you wish to study, but this poor brother doesn't even know the difference between right and wrong. Who will teach him if I don't? I am going to keep him here even if the rest of you leave." As he said, he looked over and the person who was the thief, his face, were a torrent of tears was flowing down the face of the person who had stolen these goods. And he never stole again. My friend Genjo, who was so immature and such a jerk, you know, and in fact, he was really played a hand in destroying our group, really. You know, really. He was single-handedly helped to blow the whole place to pieces. Years later, flash forward 15 years, something like that, not 15, but 10. I was at Eido Roshi's place. And who should I meet but Genjo, right? What a different man. What a different person. It was like the koan says 3 days can make a difference. That's the truth. You know, nobody is, I'm not going to be the same person in a week. And I'm not going to be the same person in 5 years. And nobody is anybody else in this room. Always changing. Oh, and we're all trying to change. We're all trying to change in a certain way. We're all trying to be better people, right? And you have to always keep that in mind. If somebody, you're sitting on the cushion and somebody's huffing and puffing, and you think, that jerk, you know. Have you seen the way he, you know, whatever, you know. He always does the same thing with his chopsticks. Every meal, you know. You know, at sashimi, things can bother you, right? You look up and you think, that guy never gets it right. You know, look at those balls. He never does it right. You know? And, idiot, you know. Anyway, this Genjo was quite a character. You know, he really was a jerk. He really was immature, in my opinion. And he was a constant annoyance. Okay. All right. After 20 years of practice, I ran into this man named Genjo at this sesshin. And he was like a different person. First thing he did, he saw me, he said, "I cannot apologize enough for my behavior. He said, "After our group fell apart, I realized I went through a long period of depression and unhappiness." He said, I worked with a therapist, you know, and I saw many things in myself that weren't right. And I continued to practice with Genki Roshi and asked his forgiveness. And he said, "I went back to graduate school and I became a psychologist myself." It was like a different person. He was just—he had utterly transformed, and there was no artificial, there was nothing artificial about him. You know, he was just totally a different person. You know, and a much better man, really. I mean, today he's the abbot of the Zen Center in Seattle, and he has, you know, I know somebody who knows one of his students, and his student had terrible psychological problems and almost killed himself. And he told my friend, he said, "You know, if it wasn't for Genjo, I would be dead today. He saved my life." You know? So the person sitting across from you at sesshin who's sniffling or annoying, you know, someday that person could be the embodiment of compassion. You know? And so we're all in this together. You know, our group has been very free from these kinds of tensions, but, you know, they're always there on some level. So please understand that, you know, cultivating a heart of forgiveness and love in the community is an essential part of practice. And please realize that, you know, I've seen a sangha, I know how precious sangha is, and I've seen it destroyed by these negative emotions, really just totally destroyed. So the survival and the survival of our community, its growth and its our community will continue to be a place that shelters life and helps people to live in a richer way. That will continue if we all work on this. We I guess that's clear. Yeah? Yunmen said to his monks one day, there's a saying, 3 days can make a different person. What about you? So if something bothers you, change yourself. See? Something bothers you. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and that guy's moving is bothering you. That's your koan today. The problem is not him, the problem is you. Change yourself. When you find yourself hating somebody, change yourself. When you find yourself resenting somebody, change yourself. What about you? Before anyone can answer, he said 1,000. This beautiful answer. You'll have to tell me what it means, okay?